said to me, this is a family secret, and you gave it up to me, boom.
Hello, and welcome to episode 83 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a show that's all about talking about movies. I am Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Christy Pachko and Angie Han.
Hey, everybody.
So this week, we have two topics for you. First, our hot topic is TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, and then we're going to jump into our weekly review, which is Black Mass. So I'm going to kick things off with the TIFF discussion, because that's why I wasn't here last week, and I had a good time. It was my first TIFF, and there was a ton of stuff to see, and I managed to cram in quite a bit. I'm going to run through some of my favorites of the film festival, and there's five that I'm kind of obsessed with right now. And I want to start with Room, because I love that book, and after reading that book, I couldn't even begin to imagine how they'd possibly bring it to screen the right way. But it is insanely effective. Like, all I can say is that after I got up, after the movie was over, I let go of my notebook, and there were, like, fingernail marks in the cover. I was gripping my notebook so hard the entire time. It's really tense. The performances are great. There's pretty much no doubt in my mind that this will get nominations. I mean, definitely performance nominations, and I wouldn't be surprised if it got a Best Picture nod, too.
Who's distributing it?
It's an A24 movie.
Do they have that kind of bankroll, do you think, to do an Oscar and a push?
I think that they're going to make sure that they do.
That'd be great. They've had amazing movies this year. I'd love to see them push.
They have. It's about time that they've hit this point. And I don't believe that they're distributing anything else. Like, I know they're holding, or I believe they're holding Green Room, another one I want to talk about, and The Witch for next year. So perhaps that's why, so they could put all their resources into the Room Oscar campaign. But speaking of Green Room, that's another A24 movie, and it's actually the first movie that I've given an A to all year. It is so much fun. It's a horror movie about a band that's traveling on the road, and they're desperate for money, so they take a gig at, like, a skinhead bar that's, like, super secluded and in the woods. And what happens is, you know, they play there and it's super tense. What if they don't like us? But that's not even the big deal. The big deal is that on their way out, someone has to go back into the green room and they stumble upon a murder scene, and then they won't let them leave. And just the shit that happens is absolutely insane. I just love the style and the visuals.
Carrie loves
the
claustrophobia.
It's so good. And there's a scene with a dog in it. But, like, it's a scene that I actually love, so
you'll
know it when you see it, I promise. So that's another great one.
It's hit a point now where when Angie and I see a movie where a cat or a dog is injured, we're like, we need to warn Perry.
Part of the reason that I won't see the movie High Rise, I don't think it was received very well at all anyway, but apparently there's some dog eating that happens in that movie, so I will not be seeing that one. Another one that I'm dying to tell everybody about is The Wave. The Wave is so freaking good, and it makes me so sad that Hollywood is putting out crap like San Andreas, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit, but The Wave is just so above and beyond American disaster movies in every respect. It's kind of insane. The performances are so good. It hits all of, like, the story beats that you'd come to expect from a disaster movie, but there's such, like, a real human quality to it. And it's just so well done. It's, like, all high quality stuff. It's not like, oh, look at this big wave and, like, a random oil tanker that's going to squish people. It's like disaster, like, in the realest sense. And it's actually all based on true facts. It's about a small town in Norway where if there's some sort of landslide, it will spark a tsunami. And apparently it can really happen. So that's another one that I really want everyone to check out.
Wow. Sounds intense. I hadn't heard of that one. The other ones I'd heard of. So what else you got for us?
The Wave is really special, and I think that's going to be Norway's entry for the Oscar this year, for the foreign language Oscar. I don't necessarily think it's going to get it just because, you know, it's a disaster movie and why would it? But I think it's great. Another movie from the Midnight Madness lineup that I really wanted to talk about was Devil's Candy, which is from the director of Loved Ones, which came out, I think it's 6 years ago, and he just never made a second film, even though that one was awesome, because he had a tough time getting another feature off the ground, which happens all the time. But thankfully, he did get this one made, because it's fantastic. It stars Ethan Embry as a father who is a struggling artist, and he's also really into metal, so he looks totally badass throughout the entire movie. Gets a great deal on a nice big house, but of course in a horror movie that means someone died in it. And sure enough, they move in, and some sort of like demonic entity starts to like fuck with his head a little bit. It's kind of like a possession movie, but not like any possession movie you've ever seen before, like where this evil entity forces him to do terrible things, but like terrible things that make him screw up in really natural ways, like as a father. Like at some point, he forgets to pick up his kid from school versus, you know, someone speaking in tongues or, you know, vomiting, things like that. It was just really refreshing. The tone of the movie is just like incredibly spot on throughout. The visuals are great. The way he incorporates the art and the metal music, it's a fantastic, super fun film. Speaking of fantastic, if you are going to Fantastic Fest, I believe it's playing there. Hopefully this thing gets picked up for distribution and also makes it easier for Sean Byrne to make a lot more movies a lot faster.
And we have a really fun transition from Devil's Candy to Black Mass, because Ethan Embry is in Devil's Candy and Rory Cochran is in Black Mass, and they were both in Empire Records, which is having like its like 25th year anniversary or something right now. So guys, timely.
It's 20. Don't make us feel older than we already do, Christy. God damn it.
Not great at math.
But on that note, all right. So here is the synopsis for Black Mass. The true story of Whitey Bulger, the brother of a state senator and the most infamous violent criminal in the history of South Boston, who became an FBI informant to take down a mafia family invading his turf.
That is a really good plot synopsis, because that's how the movie
feels.
That
is very accurate. Yeah, so Johnny Depp plays Whitey Bulger, which I assume everyone already knows. Joel Edgerton is the FBI informant, and there are like a gazillion
the agent, not the informant.
Familiar actors in this. The FBI agent. And the whole movie is full of, like, familiar character actors. Like, every 10 minutes, like, another one shows up, and you're just like, oh, what are you doing in this movie? Like, it opens with Jesse Plemons, and I was like, what? I didn't even know he was in this movie. So the experience of hearing me tell you that synopsis is really not that different from the experience of watching the movie, because it really, I said this in my review, but it really just feels like someone adapted his Wikipedia page. Like, there's a lot of stuff that happens. There's no good sense of, like, you know, what this means, what this tells us about Whitey Bulger, or any of that stuff. The other thing is the narrative surrounding this movie is, oh, this is Johnny Depp's comeback movie. Like, you know, he's going to be returned to his former glory. And I think those comparisons are a little bit overblown. I think that it is better than a lot of the work he's been doing recently. That's not saying a whole lot. There are some parts where, like, you can kind of see flashes of the old Johnny Depp, who was actually really incredible. But, like, I actually don't think that... I think he is putting in the work, and I think the director is doing him no favors.
That's interesting.
Part of the reason this thing reads like a Wikipedia page, too, is that none of the characters in it, like... none of them have any sort of arc or journey. They believe one thing, they believe they're right, and that's it.
Not even Whitey really has an arc other than that he continues. I mean, the movie keeps saying, oh, he's getting more powerful and more dangerous, but you don't really, like, see it or feel it.
Yeah, that's
because the movie never really, like, steps back and shows you, like, the effect he had on, you know,
on
whatever
Boston.
Industries he has a hand in, or even, yeah, like, on Boston in general.
They just tell you stuff. There's a lot of, Angie, you said in your review, there's a lot of saying and not telling, and, like, they'll say things like, he's been good for the city, he keeps drugs out of South Boston, and someone else is like, no, he doesn't, he sells to high schoolers, and you're like, wait, so which...
Well, that was the best part of the film, when you see him go, like, one of the best parts, I mean, when you see him go up to that old lady and hug her after they say
that,
it's like,
whatever.
It's like those are the kind of moments that
I
wanted to see more of.
My big problem with this movie was actually that I feel like Scott Cooper didn't know what kind of gangster movie he wants to make. Like, in my review for Spinoff, I said, like, I feel like we saw the start of three different movies, because it starts off with Jesse Plemons, and he's, like, a thug who worked for Whitey, but in the beginning of the movie, he's already in the FBI, like, talking about what happened. So I was like, okay, so is this gonna be, like, The Departed, where, like, he was a young buck coming through all of this, and he was really enamored with Whitey, but this is him kind of having to pay for his crimes and, like, the disillusionment of all that. And then it's like, nope, forget that guy. Now we're going to focus on Whitey Bulger, or, like, for a bit. And then it's like, here's Whitey playing gym with his mom. Here's Whitey playing with his son, who he super loves. And then it's like, okay, forget about that for a bit. Now we're going to go over to John Connolly. And I thought, oh, so this is going to be, like, an American Hustler thing, where it's going to be about their, like, weird relationship. But But instead, the movie wants to do all those things, and it can't pull that off. So then it just feels like, I said in my review, it felt like, similar to what Angie said about the Wikipedia thing, to me it felt like a 10-year-old giving you, like, an oral report on history, but he's, like, tired. We're just like, and then this happened. Oh, wait, but I forgot to tell you, then this other thing happened, and you're like, oh my god, what the fuck? Like, there's no sense of narrative flow, and the movie wants you, they keep telling you that Whitey's getting worse and more dangerous, but the movie doesn't make that evident, because they're like, oh, Whitey, like, don't kill anybody, but we've already seen him kill people, so, like, him killing more people doesn't seem to have a whole lot of weight to it dramatically. But the thing I liked about the movie is that, I agree with Angie in that I think the Depp's performance is the best he's done in years, but really, like, what the fuck does that mean anymore? I still think he's garbage in it, but whatever. But there are a lot of good performances in it, and it became this thing where anytime a new actor would show up, I was like, maybe they will make this movie interesting and fun. And some of them do, but only for like 5 minutes at a clip, and then they're gone again.
I will say, when Corey Stoll shows up, the movie immediately snaps into place. A lot of that is his performance, but a lot of it is also just the fact that he is the catalyst for everything that happens in the third act that, like, leads to people having consequences.
It's also because it's so damn refreshing to hear someone, like, tell it as it is. You know, at this whole time we're watching people kill people and do these terrible things and be like, it's okay, it's good for the city. And then all of a sudden this guy kind of comes in and just says what you're thinking, where, you know, it's wrong, he's illegal, and someone needs to stop him.
Also, he's one of the few people that didn't bother to have a Boston accent, even though it would have made sense for him to, but I'm fine that he didn't, because some of those Boston accents, oh man, like,
can we talk about Benedict Cumberbatch and what the fuck he is doing in this movie? Like,
I think he thought he was a Kennedy. I don't know what it was.
He's trying to do Kennedy, but, like, his accent is really distracting. Actually, a lot of the accents in this movie are so distracting that I'm like, it would have been less distracting to just have a movie set in South Boston where no one has a Boston accent. Like, for the first 5 minutes, I would have been like, that's weird, and then I would have settled into it. But, like, every time Benedict Cumberbatch showed up, like, all I could focus on was, like, what is that accent he's doing? He doesn't sound British, but he doesn't really sound American. He definitely doesn't sound like he's from Boston, and, like, I couldn't hear anything he was saying because I was too busy being like,
it also, what Cumberbatch casting makes zero sense, because at one point he says, do you remember 20 years ago when we were doing envelopes for my first campaign? I'm like, how old is he supposed to be? Because he looks maybe 35, so for, like, 20 years ago, it makes no sense. And then also he's supposed to be Whitey's brother, but they look, like, not only do they not look anything alike, they don't behave in a way that you believe they're brothers, and, like,
the movie also never gives that relationship any room. So, like, the movie's like, oh, they're brothers, but if the movie didn't tell you that, like, if there wasn't actually a voiceover saying that's his brother, you would just think they were two strangers together.
Say again?
There's only one scene in the whole movie. There's only one scene in the whole movie where they're together, right?
There's two.
That sounds about right. There might be one more.
There's, like, Christmas, and then there's that one meal where he tells him, like, hey, John Connolly wants to talk to you. They're, like, that's literally the only scenes I can remember. But that's kind of the problem, that it's, like, that's an interesting dynamic that you literally have one of the biggest gangsters in American history whose brother is a U.S. politician that's doing really well. That's an interesting story, but we barely get there. Like, it's just the movie's trying to tell you so many things. And then it, like, casually they're like, oh, yeah, well, Whitey was part of LSD trials in prison. He did it 50 times. And I'm like, stop just throwing shit at me. Like, give me something. And because there's no protagonist, so there's nothing to, like, grip onto to pull you through the movie. It's just stuff. It's just stuff happening, and it doesn't feel connected. It's very frustrating. I actually ended up watching this morning on Investigation Discovery some TV show about, like, Whitey Bulger, and it was, like, digging into the details. And I enjoyed that a lot more, one, because it was only an hour, and two, because it had a clear focus. It was like, look at the crazy shit this guy did while the FBI was supposedly aware of him. Like, that was interesting.
Yeah, like, this movie just keeps telling you stuff that happened, but, like, it's weird because Scott Cooper and the screenwriters use voiceover a lot to tell you, like, what you're watching, but they are weirdly afraid to tell you what they think of it or what you should think of it. And, like, I'm not saying that I want a movie that's, like, very preachy and just tells me exactly how to interpret things, but, like, they just kind of present events to you with, like, no, you know, again, it's like a Wikipedia page. It just like, lays out stuff that happened, and it's just like, am I supposed to be, like, excited or, like, upset? Am I supposed to be rooting
for someone?
You know
what my favorite stuff was? My favorite stuff was the Peter Sarsgaard
stuff. Oh, he was so good.
He was great.
I found He was so good, and I found that character so, like, erratic and fascinating. And instantly, I just never knew what he was going to
do. Yeah, and you instantly got who that character was. As soon as they introduced him in a scene where there's fucking voiceover again, and he murders two people in 2 seconds, and you know who that character was. And, like, Angie, I think you talked about it afterwards. You were like, why wasn't he Whitey Bulger?
Yeah.
Which, yes, a million times yes.
Like, part of the
Sarsgaard would have.
That's really funny. Part of the problem is, like,
Sarsgaard's scary.
Sorry. Can you repeat that?
I was saying Sarsgaard is scary.
Oh my god!
Like, he
say
has
that
a sense of menace on screen.
Sarsgaard.
But, like, you know, that was the thing. Like, and the other problem that that Angie and I talked about after we saw the movie together was that Johnny Depp, one, I think. I don't think he can ground a normal human performance anymore.
This is almost
one. We talked about in our Transcendence podcast.
This is almost one. The problem is that the stuff he's doing is buried under like 8 pounds of prosthetics on his face. It's distracting. It actually makes it so he can't move his face like a normal person, which is really bizarre. Like, I was, so at some point I noticed that he had forehead wrinkles but couldn't actually move his forehead. And then I spent the rest of the movie watching everyone's foreheads and being like, maybe that's not a thing. Maybe foreheads aren't supposed to move. And I'd be like, oh, but like Juno Temple's forehead looks like it moves when she's like making facial expressions and talking. And like, so does Peter Sarsgaard's. I don't know. Maybe it's weird that the makeup is distracting.
Well, and the other thing that you pointed out to me.
He doesn't look like Whitey Bulger that much. I looked up a picture of Whitey Bulger and then I was like, oh my god, he looks like a normal person and not like some sort of like lizard human. So, like.
With vampire eyes, with fucking weird looking blue like, okay, Whitey Bulger actually had blue eyes. So Johnny Depp, who doesn't, had to wear contacts, I guess. But when they put those contacts in and were like, oh, you look like you're from fucking Twilight, they should have ditched them. It's, I said in my review, it's like the fucking American Sniper fake baby. It is so distracting that I was being pulled out of the moment to just be like, what with those eyes?
Yeah, it's,
like, they don't reflect light properly.
It's not that
They're
hard.
They're so strange.
It's not that hard to find color contacts. I've known people who've worn color contacts that don't make them look like, you know, the eyeball equivalent of the American Sniper baby, as you were saying. Like, it's bizarre.
They're really bizarre. It's distracting. Like, it genuinely was getting in the way of me watching the movie because they keep cutting back to those eyes. And it's funny because if you look at the posters for this movie, sunglasses. Always with the sunglasses. A lot of the promotional images they're putting out there, sunglasses.
It's sunglasses,
like,
or he's
someone
like, it's
realized
like a profile
this is a problem.
Shot. Like, you can tell that they know it looks weird close up. And it really does. Like,
it looks like a monster
I feel like
I'm tempted to make.
Johnny Depp has just, like, dug himself a hole that's going to be impossible to crawl out of. Like, he's got a habit of doing these stupid things where he's, like, caked in makeup and wearing ridiculous stuff. But on top of that, it's just at a point where, you know, any movie he's in and any performance he gives, it's going to be like, oh, this is the best Johnny Depp performance since, like, X movie or whatever. It's just, it's at a point where it's impossible to detach, like, him and what he's done in his career for the past few years. Mm-hmm. Like, from his performance.
I'm actually
like,
scrolling through trying to find.
I can't imagine watching him, even in a role without any makeup like that, where I'm like, oh, this is Johnny Depp, like, naturally playing a character.
I think the last movie I liked him in might have been The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus in 2009, but he's only in it for, like, 8 minutes or something.
Huh.
Wow,
he was
God,
good in
I'm
Rango.
Just keep scrolling back.
It's a voice role, but he was good in it.
It's a voice role. He was probably
well,
dressed
that's the
as
thing.
A lizard.
You need to not see his face.
Yeah.
As long as we don't see his face, he could do
like
he
Eddie Murphy.
Just, that'll be his
or
thing.
Mike Myers.
He should just do animation for the rest of his life.
Well, I wrote a piece after not Lone Giant,
Lone
Ranger.
After
Lone Ranger, I wrote a piece for Cinema Blend where I basically compared Johnny Depp to Mike Myers, saying that, like, we've loved him too hard, and his mind is broken, and he thinks everything he does is golden, and so he did Lone Ranger. And it's now funny to me because, like, yeah, I don't have a problem with him in voice roles, so maybe he should just do, like, Mike Myers and just do that for a little while. Just stop caking on the makeup and doing nonsense on screen.
I
can't.
Say,
I can't with
sometimes
it.
It almost felt like this was a voice role because the Uncanny Valley is so bad with Johnny Depp's makeup that at times it kind of, like, I would see characters that look recognizably human interacting with him, and it felt like I was, like, watching those scenes of Mary Poppins where there's, like, cartoon birds that are, like, talking to them, like... I was like,
especially because his performance, I think, is just a little too cartoony. It's a little too something. Because there's a scene between him and Dakota Johnson, who I actually think is very good in this movie, even though she's only in it for like 5 hot minutes. But, like, they're talking about their son, and he's in this very dire state, he's very sick. And Dakota's performance is heart-wrenching. And his performance, I kept thinking, did you shoot this when she wasn't in the room? Like, it didn't feel like they were it didn't feel like they were in the same scene. Partially because they're shot in separate shots, and, like, it felt like the energy was totally disparate.
The one time that I thought his performance was spot on was that dinner table scene with the other FBI agent where he, like, made a joke about
the recipe.
You said it was a family secret.
That's not a Boston accent.
You know what's funny? Basically every scene in this movie that I would peg is, you know, maybe that was my favorite scene. That's the promotional clips they released. There was that. There was the scene with Peter Sarsgaard where he tries to give him the money. Take the money. You know.
I thought that the dinner party scene was good. And while I was watching it, when it came up, I immediately was like, no wonder it was the first thing they released because it's the best scene in the movie. And then there's another scene that immediately follows it where he's talking to John Connolly's wife, who's played by Julianne Nicholson, who has nothing to do but does a really good job with the nothing she's given it to do. And that was a scene where I couldn't take my eyes off. And, like, that to me felt like the old Johnny Depp where you just, like, can't look away, where you're just, like, mesmerized by his performance and, like, where he just kind of radiates this charisma that just, like, you know, pulls you in his grip. And, like, that was, like, a scene where I was just like, oh, so that's the old Johnny Depp. But then the rest of the movie, like, I feel like even when he is trying, Scott Cooper just, like, kneecaps him by making such a shitty movie.
Yeah. I also really got into the material with Juno Temple.
She is amazing.
Because that was one of
only in it for 5 minutes, but those are the best 5 minutes of the movie.
She's great, but it's also that's like one of the few sequences in the movie that almost feels like a complete story in and of itself, what happens to her. And also, I just loved the subtlety of what that did to Rory Cochrane's character, too. How, like, you saw that he was, like, finally processing how wrong what they were doing was. And the rest of the movie is kind of devoid of any of that.
A thing I found out from watching that Investigation Discovery, that was actually the second time that had happened with one of his girlfriends, though. Crazy, right?
See, I'd be more interested to know, like, about that.
So one thing I thought was really interesting, I was talking with a friend of mine who lives in Boston, who saw this movie in Boston, packed theater, said the audience fucking ate it up and loved it. And I said, do you think, being from Boston and being aware of what the Whitey Bulger story ahead of time helped watching this movie, because my theory was, like, maybe it's like when you read the book and then you watch the movie, and people that haven't read the book are like, I didn't really understand this part or how these things connected, but you bring that to it, so you're good. And he said he really loved the movie, and he thinks maybe that is part of it. So it has that kind of thing where, like, if you already know the story going in and you already have attachments to what you think of Whitey, I think then you can fill in these gaps that we're talking about. But if not, it just feels so disconnected. It's very frustrating. And I swear to God, if this...
Well, it's not a story. That's the thing. It's like if you're aware of something, there is an inherent thrill about seeing it come to life on screen. So I could understand why someone from Boston who knows this stuff might find it fun and entertaining to see these actors bring these situations to life. But for anyone who doesn't know it, and, like, that, you know, that's not an excuse to make a movie that way.
No, totally. I mean, I think Angie's right. The movie doesn't seem to want to take a point of view on him. And because of that, it just becomes this rant. And here's my hope, is just that these early Oscar buzz comments are bullshit and get blown up within a month, because I cannot talk about this movie through January. It's not that interesting.
It seems like this will eventually get steamrolled by, like, much worthier contenders.
I assume so, but as I told Christy, it's not Oscar season without at least one nomination that makes you so angry you want to just rage quit the entire industry. So, you know, maybe it'll be
specifically one biopic about a white guy.
Almost always, yes.
I wouldn't be surprised if it at least got a makeup nomination.
You know,
the
makeup artist did the best that with the technology that he had, but nothing short of, like, the masks from Mission Impossible would have sold that dramatic of a transformation when so much of the movie relies on it and when a lot of it is close-ups.
It is strange, too, because I guess it's because they wanted it to make it not look like Johnny Depp, but, like, a young Whitey Bulger was not a bad-looking guy, so they could have got away with him looking a little more Johnny Depp-like. It wouldn't have been a big deal.
Like a fucking lizard, so... The real Johnny Depp looks more like Whitey Bulger than, like, the Whitey Bulger Johnny Depp does.
All right, so basically the consensus on this is a big fat pass.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
It's fuck you, Scott Cooper.
It's boring.
Yeah.
If you want to enjoy the best parts of the movie, just go online and watch the clips.
Or those were the bright spots.
The only thing you'll be missing then is Juno Temple.
I would suggest a combination of watching the clips and then going on Wikipedia. Also, Juno Temple is in it, but she's playing a prostitute for about the 87th time in her career. So just watch one of our other movies.
That's exactly what I said the second I walked out of the movie. I forgot who I was standing with, but I turned to them and I'm like, you know, Juno Temple just always plays the whore who dies, doesn't she? movie she's in.
And it's, you know what? In Brass Teapot, she makes it through. I think that's on Netflix, and it's adorable. So look that one up, friends.
In Far From the Madding Crowd, she plays the whore that dies.
She does it in Sin City, man. I think, too, right?
Yeah. I think she might make it through Sin City,
maybe she lives,
though,
but
right?
She's definitely a prostitute in that one, too. I like Juno Temple. I want better things for her.
Same
as
here.
Do I. So, like, that's the big takeaway from this movie, is that more good stuff for Juno Temple and Peter Sarsgaard,
please. Yeah.
All right. That is a wrap on episode 83 of Popcorn and Prosecco. You guys know the drill. Please go over to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. It would also be super nice if you rated and commented there. We have our website, popcornprosecco.com. Please like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Popcorn Prosecco, and then all three of us are all over the internet as well. Christy, you want to take it
first?
Yeah,
you can find me on Twitter at Christy Puchko, KristyPuchko, and I write all over the web, but you can find my career highlights at decadentcriminals.com.
You can find me on Twitter at AJHAN, and I write for slashfilm.com.
And you can catch me on Twitter at PNemiroff, and all of my writing, including my TIFF coverage, is at Collider.com. So thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
What's the family secret recipe?
It's ground garlic and a little bit of soy.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it.